This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
To the highway, in a brand new day, over the rainbow, gotta let it go. So bold, rain is a gun. Fast to freedom,
stars tonight.
Welcome back to Open the Voice Gate for October 8th, 2020. We are members of the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. You can find us on the Voices of Wrestling feed, or you can find us on our own dedicated feed on all podcast platforms and applications. You can follow us on Twitter at Open Voice Gate. If you'd like to donate to the show, just click the link in the show notes. It'll take you to our Red Circle page. You press the red button, and you can do a one-time or reoccurring donation. No obligation whatsoever, but we'd certainly appreciate it, and would like to thank all of our previous donors. I'm one of your hosts. It's your old pal, R. Mike Spears, and joined as always by Case Lowe. And Case, how are you? Are you feeling pretty boku right now? Because I'm feeling pretty boku at this moment.
Mike, I am not as well cultured as you. I don't necessarily have the worldly view that you do. So I think in order to answer this question, I need you to define that word for me.
So I actually did do research into this because I do know a level of Japanese, but I don't know like syntax. Like I can pick up some stuff. Boku is a masculine pronoun that's usually used when you are of like a teenage, like referring to yourself as or your friends as like boku. It's basically like feeling like you're a lad. You know, like that's the best thing. It's lad, and it's something that if you're older and male, you might use boku when you're trying to like re-engage in your youth.
It's kind of the embodiment of perhaps the Steve Buscemi "How do you do, fellow kids?" gif. If you're the age of, say, a Naruki Doi using that word.
Yeah. Or guys being dudes.
Guys being dudes. Well, I'm Buku AF, Mike. How about that?
You know, I'm feeling that way too. I mean, this is the most dudes rock thing of Dragon Gate going on right now. But that's kind of been one of the big topics of this last week in Dragon Gate, as we are going to talk this week a little bit about the Fukuoka doubleheader. We're going to talk about Korakuen. We're going to talk about the big table setting that they have done for the next few months. As we've been talking about for the last few weeks, Case, we're on the precipice of probably the busiest month in the history of the Dragon System, and it feels like that there's a lot of table setting going on here, and we'll talk about that. Some returns, some debuts, some big swerves, and then also looking ahead to Kyoto. So it's been an interesting week, I would say, in Dragon Gate. Not necessarily, in my opinion, like one that it's like all these matches are match of the year things, but for like Dragon Gate fans, especially like your week in, week out Dragon Gate fans, it was like a certain familiarity I felt like watching these three shows, and how they kind of, you're like, okay, we're table setting here, and it was a pleasant time. It's not necessarily like the most like star rating sign, but it's one of those shows that you watch. I feel like watching these three shows, I came away from them ultimately satisfied.
I think the Korakuen Hall show in particular on October 7th felt like the truest sense of a TV taping, where, I mean, I thought the main event was excellent, but you're looking at one really great match, but then a lot of different things spliced throughout the entire card that will come to fruition either in early November at Gate of Destiny, or stuff that we will see morph and evolve as we close out 2020 and head into the new year. There's just a lot of stuff to like on those shows, and what we saw was the formation and the foundation of a lot of this stuff taking place. I mean, with the Brave Gate scene, we're kind of leading to the finality of that and the rivalry between Okuda and Ishida. But a lot of the stuff is, like you said, it's table setting. It's getting us prepared for the huge, huge month of November. and I'm really satisfied with it. We're going to talk a little bit about the Fukuoka double shot from this past weekend, which I will say up top was perhaps the most enjoyable Fukuoka double shot they've done. That's not to say it was anything special, but it was painless to watch, which is a nice change of pace in Fukuoka. And then the Korakuen show, which again, not spectacular, but in the midst of tournament season, when you've got a Champions Carnival that disappointed until the very last match, when you've got an N1 that delivered but was inconsistent, and a G1 where seemingly the A block is delivering and the B block is falling short, Dragon Gate continues to be the one true consistent promotion.
Yeah, and like that might be my biggest takeaway, that other than like our inherent bias, when I look at what promotions have done in 2020, even grading it on the scale of 2020 as a year, like, and like none other, Dragon Gate has put out, like with this weekend, especially with how we dread Fukuoka shows, they've put out the most enjoyable product that I feel like that even if you are someone that goes in and you're a pure work rate person, there's enough stuff going on here that I mean, like, just like three-star city, but it's like a pleasant three-star city, but it's, we like watch this and it's pretty clear to me like how far ahead Dragon Gate is from everyone else in the world right now in storytelling and putting together, I feel like, entirely satisfying shows and playing to their audience in a way that I feel like a lot of promotions have had to kind of ignore because of COVID restrictions. Dragon Gate's figured it out, and I think it's something that if you're someone who just dips into Dragon Gate, just listens to the show, you're probably like, oh, you're being hyperbolic. But it's worth seeking out like these things because week in, week out, I feel like, and it's been a thing since July, that Dragon Gate has put out some of the most enjoyable wrestling in the world right now.
I think it goes back to January. I mean, I was really high on that January Korakuen Hall show, and then we saw the KZ Challenge in February and the Champion Gate stuff in March before things got shut down. But you're exactly right. I mean, for me, given the year that New Japan has had and the struggle that they've had adapting to the limited capacity space, now granted, I'm a few shows behind the G1, so maybe that will change after I say this, but this is the first year where I can definitively say in a long time that Dragon Gate has had a better in-ring year than New Japan. But New Japan started off the year so hot. I mean, January, February, March, I guess January, February, they never ran shows in March. I was so into New Japan and thought we were going to have this great year of Dragon Gate and New Japan as being my central focuses in wrestling. New Japan disappointed me when they returned from their COVID hiatus, and so that attention has been shifted to Dragon Gate. But outside of the in-ring perspective, that's not what is important here. I feel like, especially in Japan, where, you know, Big Japan booking is just atrocious. It's just another level of horrible. And All Japan booking, which I'm not super connected to, but I know enough All Japan hardcores that either are desperate for Miyahara to get back to the top of the card to bring stability to the company, or are looking for Miyahara to be used even less and to push some new talent. There's a lot of dissatisfaction within the hardcore Western All Japan fan base. Noah, I just hate the way they book. I feel like they've been doing the same thing with slightly different guys and slightly different unit names for the last 3 or 4 years, despite some highs in the in-ring this year, most of those being Masaki Mochizuki related. But still, Noah can deliver a good show, but I'm not invested in their booking at all. And if you're comparing Dragon Gate's booking to New Japan, the Evil World title run was offensive and awful and dreadful. And look, Tetsuya Naito doesn't exactly light my world on fire as the top guy in the company. I ultimately think he is best served as an El Generico chasing figure rather than the top dog. So I've been completely disinterested in New Japan's booking for the entire year. The one company, and I know it's this podcast and we are the host and we cover Dragon Gate closer than anyone. There is an inherent bias there. You're right, Mike. But I feel like past the in-ring product, what we have loved so much this year is just how solid the booking has been. And I think that was very apparent on the Gate of Victory Korakuen Hall show. And a lot of that was set up by the doubleheader in Fukuoka.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. And let's use that to transition talking about Fukuoka. I'm going to run down the results real quick, Case, and then we can give our big takes. I mean, they were Fukuoka shows, but they still are Fukuoka shows. So, like, match to match, like, there's not really a lot to talk about, but there are some big things coming out of Fukuoka that definitely applied into Korakuen. So I'm going to do that, and then we can give our big takes. So that works for you.
Please.
All right, so the first show was on October 4th. Both these shows were on October 4th. They'll be on the network until the 12th. Attendance was 294 for the afternoon show, which was down from the evening attendance from the last show, which was 333. However, across the double shot, they drew 55 more fans. So they were at 636 for this month, whereas they were at 585 last month. But going through the results from the afternoon show, opened with a Dragon Gate versus Toriumon tag. Keisuke Okuda and Punch Tominaga lost to Naruki Doi and Don Fuji when Fuji pinned Tominaga with the Ghetto Clutch. Six-man tag, Problem Dragon Mandai Ryu, Dragon Daya, and Jimmy versus the RED team of Kaito Ishida, Takashi Yoshida, and Diamante. Diamante got the pin on Jimmy with the Vuelta finale in 11 minutes and 5 seconds. Match 3 was another unaffiliated tag. You had the Toriumon team of Ultimo Dragon, Dragon Kid, and Shuji Kondo versus the unaffiliated team of Benkei, Gamma, and Ho-Ho Lun. And it was Kondo getting the pin on Lun in 11 minutes and 20 seconds with a King Kong Lariat. Match 4 was a singles match. Ryosu Shimizu and Yamato went to a non-contest in 12 minutes and 44 seconds due to RED interference. Match 5 was Dragon Gate versus RED 8-man tag. Dragon Gate was KZ, Yosuke Sanmaria, Kota Minoru, and Jason Lee. RED was Ada, BB Hulk, Kai, and Kazuma Sakamoto. Kai pinned Yosuke Sanmaria with the Meteor Impact in 17 minutes and 36 seconds. The main event was the Kyushu Pro Tag Team Championship match, where the champions of the Toriumon team of Susumu Yokosuka and Genki Horiguchi successfully made their first defense against the Kyushu Pro team of Mentai Kid and Kodai Nozaki. And then we look into the afternoon show. The evening show had 3:42 there, opened with a Buku tag of Naruki Doi, Ryo Saito, and Ryotsu Shimizu versus the unaffiliated team of Genki Horiguchi, Gamma, and Ho-Ho Lun. It was Shimizu pinning Lun with the Ultimo style Magistral Cradle. Singles match went to a 15-minute time limit draw between Kento Kobune and Takedo Kamei. The next match was a trios match. Ultimo Dragon, Madoka Kakuta, and Jimmy beating Takashi Yoshida, Kazuma Sakamoto, and Diamante, the Triangle Gate champion team, when Kakuta scored the first pinfall of anyone in the class of 2020 when he got a schoolboy on Yoshida in 13 minutes. Match 4 was a Dragon Gate versus Toriumon 8-man tag. It was the Dragon Gate team of Yosuke Sanmaria, Keisuke Okuda, Jason Lee, and Problem Dragon Mandai Ryu versus the Toriumon team of Masato Yoshino, Dragon Kid, Susumu Yokosuka, and Shuji Kondo. It was Yokosuka getting the win with the Yokosuka Cutter and on Problem Dragon 16 minutes and 55 seconds. Match 5 was a special singles match with two people that I wouldn't argue as necessarily making a special singles match, but that's just commentary. It was Don Fuji defeating Punch Tominaga with the Hime in 7 minutes and 7 seconds. Semi-main was a straight tag between Dragon Gate and RED, KZ and Dragon Daya versus Ada and Kaito Ishida. Ada got the win with the Imperial Uno on Daya. Main event of the Across Ukuyo shows was a Dragon Gate versus RED 6-man tag. Yamato, Benkei, and Kota Minoru representing Dragon Gate versus the RED team of BB Hulk, Kai, and Hyo. It was Yamato over Hyo in 18 minutes and 42 seconds with the Galleria. So just like the results-wise, I mean, there's a lot of stuff to really get into in the evening card. Did you have any like big takeaways from the afternoon card at all?
The afternoon card was fun. I think the first three matches you can skip. There's nothing there. But I really liked matches 4, 5, and to an extent 6. I mean, 6 was fun to watch because you had Mentai Kid, who is a dollar store hubbo, and you had Kodai Nozaki, who looks like Yuji Hino ate Shigehiro Iri, and out came just a monster of a man. But specifically in matches 4 and 5, you've got Shimizu versus Yamato, which, like you said, that match ended in no contest due to an RED interference. I was all in on this match before the interference spot, because I think, like I've been saying, we were so bogged down and had gotten so used to this sleazy Shimizu who worked a step slower, wasn't quite as quick as the rest of the roster, and maybe relied more on a snarl or a facial expression than his pure work. Shimizu was back, and maybe he's not going to be able to show just how good of a wrestler he is teaming with Saito and Tominaga, but it's okay because there is a core value to Shimizu that I have not seen in a long time that returned in this Yamato match. I thought they were building to a legitimately great match before the interference spot, but it was match 5 of the afternoon show that was arguably my favorite match of the entire weekend, that Keizi, Minoru, Lee, and Maria versus Eita, Holt, Kai, and Sakamoto. And Mike, that is because of the performance of Yosuke Santamaria and her battles with Kai. I thought she was brilliant in this match, but we did not talk about these shows at all. I don't know if this match even registered with you, but I thought Maria was terrific.
I completely co-sign on matches 1 through 3. I was... Shimizu and Yamato, I thought it was entirely enjoyable, but it was very lighthearted, and in a way that through watching these three shows, I probably would go back and, like, I went 3 on this, but in retrospect, it probably is a match that I'm more fond of. But yeah, the key matchup of this weekend, or at least on the show, was Kai versus Maria. Those two just had, like, a blast of a stretch. And then you also had, like, how everyone was really doing great interplay work, and this is kind of a match that they ran a very similar version of it in Korakuen as the main event, and just everyone was going on full gear. Just was a full out thing. Hulk looked great in this as well. This was a truly exceptional match and easily the match of the night. And I like Kodai Nozaki. He looks like I think he looks more like a combination of Irie and Ryo Tahama personally, but he does have the largest thighs I've ever seen on a pro wrestler. He is just wide. He's a big man, but the semi-main was an absolute blast. Like this was definitely worth going out there, going out of your way to watch. It might be something just because if you don't want to mess around with all the other matches on the show, when the Infinity Cut goes up, I bet this one makes the Infinity. So you might want to hold off for that if you're not looking at jumping on the network immediately, in my opinion.
I thought Maria's performance in that tag match and her bouncing off of Kai, it reminded me a lot of Masato Yakushiji of Michinoku Pro fame, where he was someone that was, even on the Michinoku roster, was smaller than everybody else, and whether it was a Dick Togo or a Taka Michinoku, whatever hot heel they had at the time, seemed to always do the most amount of damage to Yakushiji. And Maria, obviously given her former friendship with Kai and Tribe Vanguard, seemingly her reoccurring allegiance to Yamato, and just the dynamics of the soft babyface Maria with this new rogue heel Kai. I just thought this worked perfectly for a Road 2 tag match like this was. I don't know why in particular this match jumped out at me. I went 3 3/4 with it and really flirted with going 4. Simply off of their interplay alone. Everyone else in the match was fine, but anytime Kai and Maria were in the ring, I thought their interactions were electric, and I was already into this Yamato versus Kai storyline. I'm pumped we're getting a big hyped singles match between the two, because really, it's not like we get a ton of non-title important singles matches, so we're getting Yamato versus Kai at Gate of Destiny. And I thought the slow build, or I guess just the small build in the grand scheme of things, of Kai going after Maria here was a home run. I thought that match was really, really excellent.
Yeah. I went 3.5, so I was only a shade lower than you on this. It just was something that, like, when we've talked about Maria in the past, when she is playing like this scrappy underdog babyface, it is some of the best performances that the company has. And showing that immediate chemistry with Kai was something special. And then, yeah, the way that they've kind of been like, all right, these special singles matches on big shows are usually the KZ special, but now we're going to have like a heated feud into the mix, really excites me for Gate Destiny. It's something that, you know, with them having 2 huge cards in 12 days, that's a smart idea to like use this as something to build up a show that, you know, I mean, you have to get stuff done for. And I feel like that was really remarkable, and it's worth going out of your way for. Any other big takeaways you have for the Kyushu Tag Championship match? I mean, Mentai Kid, I've seen a lot of. He always kind of like reminds me more of like a, and this is no knock on him because I really enjoy this wrestler I'm about to throw this comp onto. He reminds me of like a second generation Billy King Kid in a way.
Yeah, that is a really good comp.
And it's not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing. And it's I mean, it was fine. I mean, I will say the most flagrant violation of crowd cheering rules happened in this match when there actually were crowd calls for the Kyushu Pro guys. So they brought their fans and they were rowdy for this match. And then, yeah, Nozaki is just like a bowling ball of a man who is the only person I've seen to convincingly do a 1 minute head scissors hold. And I'm like, you know what? It probably would take me a minute to either pass out or figure out a way between this guy's like ham hock legs.
The match was fun. I really thought the Kyushu Pro guys were going over, and when they didn't, it made me really intrigued to see, I guess, when and where Horiguchi is going to drop those belts. I mean, it'll probably happen on a Kyushu Pro show, which makes sense. I thought they would give the locals the rub here, and they did not. But the match was fun. I mean, I went 3.5 with it. I liked the interplay that they had, and it was perhaps the most enjoyable three-match stretch I've seen on a Fukuoka show, because although I liked the evening show a lot, the matches that I liked there were a little bit more dispersed throughout the card. So I was pumped coming off that afternoon show. I was in a good mood watching the show, which doesn't exactly happen in this town all that often post-Takata Star Lanes.
Yeah, yeah. The one last note about the day show. After defending their Kyushu Pro Tag titles, Yokosuka and Horiguchi made a challenge for the Twin Gate, so that was our second title match at Gate of Destiny signed. It will be Kota Minoru and Jason Lee making the second defense of the Open the Twin Gate titles against the Toriumon team. And the evening show, there was stuff I think I liked on the evening show more than what I liked on the afternoon show, but I think you're absolutely right. Like, there is like a there is stuff that kind of just like slows the show down, so it's not necessarily like a stretch out of here that was really great. It was more of just like picking and choosing, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, if I had the pencil, I'd be booking KZ and Daya versus Eita and Ishida in every town I run in. I mean, I want a version of that match at Korakuen Hall. I want a version of that match on a pay-per-view. I want a version of that match in Osaka. I thought their chemistry was just off the charts. And to me, that is the future of the company. I mean, those are the four guys that I would be investing my stock in, with, you know, maybe hedging a little bit for Kento Kobune and Sora Fujikawa, but those are the guys that matter. And that's no slight on, say, a Benkei. Benkei's just held the Open the Dreamgate title before. I think KZ, Daya, Eita, who's the current champion, and Ishida, who's the current Bravegate champion, when I'm looking at the future, I think those are the guys that are going to really be in the mix. I thought that match was just absolutely terrific. And then the other news is the time limit draw that the rookies had in match 2 and the Kakuta victory in match number 3.
Yeah, so my quick thoughts on this semi-main event. I thought this match was really interesting because how much of the match was basically KZ versus Eita and Ishida. Like, Daya was there, but Daya came in for moments and that was it. This was basically like almost like a handicap match in a way, other than getting falls broken up. And I thought like this was like one of those matches that like this is the Dragon Gate near future, whereas the rookies were seeing the far future. You know, like, this is the next 3 years versus the next 10 years. So
I know it sounds dumb to say this, like, this is a really basic and obvious thing to say, but KZ is so good. Like, he is really, I mean, he does small stuff, and it's just a weird thing with Dragon Gate where I don't know if the tastemakers will see this the way they should. And I think just it's, although I think the promotion is incredibly accessible, there's a narrative that says otherwise, but KZ's doing stuff in this match where he's like fighting off arm ringers. Like, Ishida's just trying to twist his arm like any wrestling match is featured ever, and KZ is fighting valiantly to prevent that. And this is like 2 minutes into the match. Like, everything he does is interesting. Everything he does is with maximum effort. He's great on the mat. We've seen him brawl. We've seen him fly. He is as complete of a package. He's a five-tool player, Mike. I mean, he's unbelievable. And I don't think he's winning the belt at Gate of Destiny. If he does, oh boy, we are going to have some fun on this show. Because one, we can start digging that grave for Eita real quick. And two, I'm all aboard KZ being the champion. I think it's going to happen eventually. I just don't think it's going to happen in November. But I, you know, for as much as we sort of doubt Eita and have our issues with him, and I don't even think it's his fault that this reign has been a little lackluster. I think that's the booking around him. But it's Eita, and he has a history of not exactly living up to expectations, so you kind of have to wonder why that is. But I have no doubt that the Gate of Destiny main event is going to deliver off the fact that KZ is involved. Just off him alone, he could be wrestling a broom out there, and I'm sure I'd go 4 1/4 with it. I know it sounds dumb, but he is just really, really good, and I don't think he gets the credit for it. Because this is a guy 5 years ago that was wrestling in overalls and like, oh, he's a Brave Gate champion, we've seen his peak, and he blew that out of the water. And it's been this gradual transition for the past decade, so it's not like, say, a Dragon Dio, where I know you were very down on him, and then all of a sudden, one day, he figured it out. We're like, oh my god, we have to pay attention to Dragon Dio now. It's just KZ, just from 2012 to 2020, has picked up some tools along the way, has lost some weight every year, has changed his gear every once in a while, and now, he's a main event guy. He's so good.
Yeah, and if anything, like, the power of KZ, and talking about accessibility, kind of leads me to a point. With some promotions acting like that they have, like, Southern-style tag team matches, this was very much a Southern-style tag team match case. Like, this is probably, like, one of the most accessible tag matches you could have out of Dragon Gate, because it was all based around the idea of KZ, the guy who's going to be your star, the guy that's going to be in your main event, dealing with, like, the two singles champions who were just picking him apart, and you weren't able to get the hot tag to the flashy youngster who comes in at the House of Fire, does vaulting handspring to Harris because he's an insane person, which that is our insane thing that Dia did this week, was he did vaulting handspring to Harris. That's wild. But it just, like, was worked in such a way that it's very easy to see, like, and it's kind of unfair almost in a way, like, you can see, like, oh yeah, KZ versus Ada, you see the clear difference there. But and that is part of Ada, that not Ada, part of KZ over the last 8 years picking up so much skill, as you said. Like, going from the biggest loss post possible, just slumming around in a work suit and crazy hair, picking up falls, to eventually, pretty much starting in 2015, him figuring it out more and more, getting injured, coming back, winning the Brave Gate champion, then being, like, the solid tag worker in Dia Hearts and Tribe and Vanguard, and then finally in 2017, everything coming together. So it's pretty remarkable, and it's one of those things that I don't think they'll make the change there. I think that title change for Ada, no matter what, is going to happen at Kobe World, if it happens at all. But great tag.
I will say real quick, last on that tag match, that tag was everything that FTR versus Jack Evans and Angelico should have been. That match that just happened on Dynamite this past week, that was the template. KZ, Dia, Ata, and Ishida laid the template for that match. That is what they could have copied, that move for move, because Evans can probably do a lot of the same stuff that Dia can do. And instead, we got the bloated FTR tag match, but that is a different Mike Spears podcast.
that's a different podcast I'll be recording later today. Yeah, no. Like, this was like, this was like the most Southern tag I've seen in a modern wrestling promotion in a while. And I think that's kind of remarkable. And it's one of those things that everyone says that Jado and Gato are such Memphis heads. Like, this is something that you would see straight out of Continental. Like, this is you could see this as an endpoint for that. Let's get into, like, the other, like, major big things that were happening on the show. Of course, we gotta talk about rookies for a second, Case. We have a 15-minute draw between Kento Kabune and Takedo Kamai. This was my match of the day. This was my favorite thing that I saw across both of the Fukuoka shows. I went 4 flat on it. And then we had a really fun Ultimo and his kids versus the Triangle Gate champion team, where after a whole lot of RED shenanigans, you had Kento Kabune going, like, I've had enough of it, clocking Yoshida in the head, and then giving the opportunity for Madoka Kakuta to get the schoolboy. As mentioned earlier, he is the first member of this class of 2020 to have a win against someone who's on the main roster, and they celebrated it. They had him on his shoulders, and that just made Takashi Yoshida flip out about it, and just was, like, a really, like, satisfying match-to-match. Like, we got to see, like, the two people at the front of the class really put it together for 15 minutes, and then you guys see Madoka Kakuta, the most interesting-looking person in wrestling, that, like, just do lariats and just chop people and just be lanky as all get out, and it was just, like, a whole bunch of fun, and at least that was my big takeaway I had from, like, this two-match stretch on the evening card.
Madoka Kakuta kind of wrestles like someone who spams moves on a WWE video game if you're playing them online.
Yeah.
Like, he's a good wrestler, but you could also make the argument that he doesn't string anything together. He is hitting discus lariats and chops and moving on with his life. Whereas Kabuna and Kamai, like, oh, that looks like professional wrestling. That's a structure of a match I've seen before. Kikuta's just a fucking weirdo. Like, that is the only way I can describe it. This dude is just weird. But, you know, we talked a little bit about Gate of Destiny just a second ago. And I wanted to ask you, given this victory and the success they all had at Korakuen Hall, are we building towards some sort of Kikuta Kabune Kamai versus Yoshida Sakamoto Diamante Triangle Gate match at Gate of Destiny?
If it's not happening at Gate Destiny, I could very easily see them making this into a three-way trios match.
Which I think is, yes, I think that's the more realistic option, is throwing a Toriumon team in the mix as well, because you're going to have to get some of those guys on the card. I mean, you could easily that's exactly it. That's probably what they'll do, is some sort of Shimizu, Tamanaga, Saito combination there, because I think Doi will be in a more important match. Mike, I think that might be the... It would be a big deal. A big deal if they gave the rookies that opportunity at Kobe World. But it's world in name. It's not the show that's happening at the end of July. And I think they've earned it. And I think that's what this comes down to, is if they all of a sudden have Kikuta, Kabune, and Kamai in a feature title match at Kobe World, you know, something that's going to happen fourth or fifth on the card, I'm not going to blink at that. That makes complete sense to me. And I think you're right in saying that, hey, that Buku tag is probably happening there with the team minus Doi, who will be doing something far more important.
I mean, he is a lad, but he's a lad with more important things on his mind, you know?
The guy in the friend group that has the real job, and, like, the other guys are still just kind of slumming around, but he's, you know, he's coming to poker night, but he's coming from the office, and he's still got the suit and tie on when he gets there. And
he just rolls up his sleeves.
You know the fellas, they're going to razz him a little bit. Ah, you know, went corporate on us, but it's Naruki Doi. He's got bills to pay.
He's not going to stay at poker night as long as everyone else, because he has to get back home. You know, he has to get to bed early because him and his wife have to go to Costco the next day. You know, maybe
it's where
I'm backyard.
Going right after this podcast. I completely understand.
but it's one of those things that, like, just like this time limit draw, it's something where, and I feel like we were so high on Kabune, especially you were so high on Kabune right after debut in the early part of this year. But, like, this show really is, like, he is, like, the most easily projectable person in this trio, because Madoka Kakuta, you might as well just write X Factor on his gear, because we just don't, who knows with him, and that's incredibly compelling. But with Kamei's big thing is that we're going to be tracking him, and a lot of things is that he's just as technically proficient as Kabune, if not more, but it's going to be how much the underdog thing is either going to propel him, like KZ, like Maria, or is it something that's going to put, like, a pretty severe ceiling on him? And that was, like, my big takeaway out of the tag match, or out of the singles match, where it got to a point where Kamei had Kabune's number. Like, when they were doing the 2-minute, 1-minute calls, it wasn't Kabune who was looking like he was putting things together, or they were going 50-50. It basically was Kamei outlasting his rival, the person that nominally is number one in the class, and just not having the time, not having the strength in him to be able to roll him up for the 3 count. And I thought, like, that was a really remarkable way to tell a story between these two guys that, I mean, they're probably going to be linked their entire career. And this is, like, one of those important matches that's going to be, like, there was the night where we went to a draw, but I had your number. If we had 5 more minutes, 3 more minutes, I would have beat you. And I thought that was a real compelling thing, and something that Fukuoka, as a crowd that likes to sit on their hands, was getting into at moments.
Oh, God. I mean, it's classic Young Lion structure. It's such an effective formula. And you're exactly right. These are guys that debuted in the same match on the same night. BB Hulk and Shingo will forever be pitted against one another, and Shingo debuted 8 months before Hulk did. So it doesn't matter where they go, if one of them leaves, if one of them gets injured, it's a similar deal to Ishida and Yamamura, but I think that is the sort of dynamic that we're looking at, is no matter what happens, the story of Kabune is incomplete without the story of Kamai.
Yeah, and it's something that I feel like that this match is going to be really worth, you're wild for that. How'd you go on this match? Because I feel like I might have been a little bit higher on you going for flat.
I went 3.5, but I don't begrudge you for going 4 at all. It is very much right up your alley.
Yeah. I mean, just, Turtle Coon, whenever Turtle Coon's putting it together, I'm invested in him. Like, he's smaller than other, he's scrappy, he chops the crap out of people, and he got to a point where it's like, I had you out on your, like, you were on your stomach, and I just didn't have the strength to roll over. I live for that kind of stuff, Case. And then the whole thing of Kakuta, like, being able to, like, get that pinfall there, and everyone just jumping in the ring, like, celebrating it was such a cool moment.
It's a great moment. I can't believe they did it on this show and not Cork and Hall. It almost seems like they jumped the gun a little bit to create a moment, because Kakuta's not from Fukuoka, is he?
I don't think Kakuta is. Give me a
no,
second.
He is. No, I'm looking at it right now. He is from Kanazawa City in the Ishikawa Prefecture. So he's not. I don't know in relation if that's close or not, but you're right. It felt like they acted like it was Kobashi and Budokan Hall winning the Triple Crown. It was unbelievable, but it was a big moment that I'm not going to put down the city anymore, but it just seemed like it was perhaps fitting for a bigger venue. But I'm glad they did it, because they carried that momentum right into Korakuen Hall.
So the Ishikawa Prefecture is north of Osaka and Kobe. So it's not in Kansai. It's not in that region, but it's the region right north of it. Just the more you know, the more you know.
Hey, look, I will take that information, Mike, and I will use it in my day-to-day life.
It is technically in the same region as Nagano, Gifu, Aichi, and of course, Shingo Takagi's home prefecture of Yamanashi. It's in the Chubu region of Japan, on the Honshu Island.
I'm glad you brought up Shingo Takagi. We're recording this his 2-year anniversary of his debut in New Japan, which is wild to think about. Can you believe Shingo's been gone for 2 years from Dragon Gate?
It's one of those things that, like, he's such a presence. He was such a presence, and, like, the way that it all happened, and, like, it's, like, something where, like, a lot of the splits and a lot of people who leave the Dragon system, it's so acrimonious, and there's so many questions there. It's one of those things that I'm like, you know what? 2 years behind, well, 24 years of, or 24 months of hindsight, I'm like, you know what? It was a big moment. It made sense for all parties. Seems to be like one of the most positive relationships they've ever had of someone leaving the system. And it's just wild, like, thinking about it, because we're also, that means that we are 2 years away from the last Hulk versus Shingo match, which is wild to think as well.
Which I believe happened in Fukuoka. I think it happened in Hakata Star Lanes, but
it was Star Lanes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But on a more, I guess, contextual and I can't think of the word I'm thinking of. Anyways, about Shingo Takagi, is that the comp for Kakuta? And I know I stumbled into this analogy because I can't think of the word, and I still can't think of what I'm trying to think of. But anyways, to move past that, after I stumbled into this, is Kakuta Shingo? I mean, according to the Gaiora website, Kakuta is a little bit shorter than Shingo on his New Japan profile. That could be New Japan working his height just a little bit. That wouldn't surprise me at all. But, you know, I think the one thing that is drastically different, and this is purely a think piece, especially coming after Cork and Hall, where I thought Kakuta and Kagetora were really laying in strikes with one another, and it seems like maybe that is Kakuta's strength, whereas Kabune is just really well-rounded, Kamai's a little more flashy, Fujikawa is very charismatic. Maybe Kakuta's this guy that can just throw hammers, and while he doesn't have the fire that Shingo had, even from match one, I mean, Shingo was just built for the part, acted like a gym class bully. He had it from day one. Kakuta doesn't have that same charisma, but I wonder from an in-ring standpoint if maybe that's what we should be looking at.
You know what? And it's also something that, like, I totally see that, especially with the idea that they're making the Discus Lariat. It seems to be Kakuta's big move early. Like, you can make, like, the one-to-one comparison to the Pumping Bomber. Like that, I feel like that's pretty easy. The interesting thing is that I feel like that Kakuta, at least, he's someone that, like, he's so, and I'm not trying to say this, like, in a way of being dismissive or like this, he's so interesting looking.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you look at him, and at least when I look at him, I'm like, I'm wondering what it would be like if he's a guy who decides to put weight on, you know? because he's someone that, like, because of his height, he looks very lanky, and I don't know if, like, his body type is one that could really, like, just go pump iron, eat a lot of protein, but it's one of those things that, like, it's something that the more I think about it, the more I understand the comp you're making there, and it's something that's interesting because, like, when you, like, looked at Shingo debuted as, like, he wasn't even debuted as a prospect. He debuted as someone in actuality, whereas Kakuta, maybe it's something where we see him slowly pick up the throws. He picks up, like, certain things and maybe gains power, gains some more mass, and I can see that happening. Like I think you might be onto something there. It'll be interesting to see that, to see how if he ends up ending up this way over the next 12 months.
And a lot of it will depend on whether or not he puts on weight, because despite his height, which he does seem to be bigger than most of the roster, he is still rail thin. Now, granted, he's a child. He's a few months younger than I am. He just turned 21, so I'm going to give him some time to put on that mass, but it seems like for all of the other rookies, we've been able to say, like, oh, they remind me of this, or they kind of act like that. Kakuta has been the one that we've been struggling for a comp, and after watching that Corkin show, I'm leaning, at least towards the early stages of his career, looking at a Shingo-type wrestler to accurately describe what Kakuta can bring to the table.
So, looking at what they're billed as, Kakuta is 5 centimeters shorter than Shingo, but he looks a lot taller because, so 5 centimeters, 2 inches, because he's 82 kilos and Shingo is billed at 96. So, and I think that's entirely body type there too, because he is very lanky, you know, he's very much
so. Like that.
So it's one of those things that'll be interesting to kind of follow up on. Other big notes of the show. We touched on this. We didn't touch on this when we were talking about the semi-main event. After the match, Ada cut a promo targeting Daya, and that would pay off immediately when we get into Corkin. Team Boku comes out to start recruiting Punch Tomonaga, which also paid off at Corkin. And then we were talking about Yamato and Kai after the main event. It was Yamato and Kai set for Gate of Destiny. Anything else you wanted to touch on Fukuoka before we get into Corkin?
No, God, I can't believe we talked about those shows for that long. Let's talk about Corkin.
All right, so Corkin was on the 7th. It will be on the network until the 14th. There is not the English version up yet. I expect it. If it's not up by the end of the weekend, I'd be stunned. Attendance, 685. Their biggest attendance since coming back in with COVID restrictions, up from 658. And should we just go from opener up on this?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, so the opener was a Dragon Gate versus Torimon tag match. It was Keisuke Okuda teaming with the Open the Twin Gate champion, Jason Lee, against Susumu Yokosuka and Yuzushi Kanda. It was Okuda getting the win over Kanda with the lights out in 10 minutes and 16 seconds. Okay, so I know in your review, you were like, this is like a breezy match that like just kind of happened. And that I never read your reviews if I'm watching the show later, just so it doesn't like color my opinion of this. But like, this was like the most like, oh, we're just going to go out there and have a decent opener tag. It's not going to be out saying we're just going to have a solid match that one could have. And I came away with this feeling like, okay, this is fine. Okuda and Yokosuka, that's interesting. Would like to see more of, but no other big takes coming out of this.
I really like what Okuda and Yokosuka bring to the table. I think they have good chemistry seemingly in every match, and it makes sense given Okuda's time in Mochizuki Dojo that they do the middle kick Jumbo no Kachi spot where those two strikes are intercepting with one another. So breezy is, I guess after hearing you say that, breezy is an interesting word to describe this very physical, very stiff match, but it was a Dragon Gate opener, so it's like, you know what it is. It's the first match at the card. We've all seen it before.
Yeah. And then we get something that we have not seen before, as it was a three-way tag team match. This was a three-way single fall match. This isn't their usual elimination rules. It was the rookie top team of Kento Kabune and Takedo Kamei versus the unaffiliated team of Masaki Mochizuki and Gamma versus the Toriumon team of Don Fuji and the returning Kenichiro Arai, my main man, Eriken. It was Kabune getting the pin on Don Fuji in 10 minutes and 6 seconds with an inside cradle. And now he has scored a win over a roster member. So big moment there. Eriken versus the rookies. I kind of turned into like a 4-on-2 match, for a lack of different words, most of this thing. And it was a really fun time.
Yeah, it's the first time we've seen Arai since the hiatus. He last worked the Champion Gate show in Osaka, where he lost his Open the Triangle Gate belt, which was just a few weeks after winning them and separating his shoulder in the process. So it was good to see him back in the fold. I mean, Arai is someone that can still go on the lower half of the card. I like when he's around. I think he adds an interesting dynamic to the roster. And I just thought this match was so brilliantly laid out, because you're right, it turned into a 4-on-2 match for most of the time. And now I don't entirely know where you go with this, because yes, Kabune and Kamai scored the fall with Kabune pinning Fuji, but it was the Masaki Mochizuki kick that knocked out Don Fuji, and then Kamai just shoved Mochizuki out of the way so his partner could get the pin. It was such a brilliant finish. It was so well done in a match that was just very entertaining from start to finish. And so that is kind of what we were talking about at the start of the show. Like, look, was this match, you know, 4 stars? Absolutely not. I went 3.5. I really liked it. But same. It's the booking literally up and down the card. You have these guys that are less than a year into their careers, and they're being given something to sink their teeth into. And clearly, from the results in Fukuoka, from this match, and from match 3, something is happening with the class of 2020. And I don't know what it is, and I still can't entirely pick up.
In the hobby, it's not easy being a fan of ripping packs or repacks. We hype ourselves up thinking, maybe I can pull a Ken Griffey Jr. rookie card. But with zero transparency on available cards and hit rates, it's all just a shot in the dark. Until now. Introducing Slab Packs from ArenaClub.com, the only repack that provides real value, a complete view of all possible cards, and clear hit rates for each one. Now, when I buy Slab Packs at Arena Club, it finally feels like I know what I'm getting. I was able to open an Arena Club slab pack, and I'll be honest, it was a lot better than what you normally do. Say you go to a card show and there's a random innocuous brown bag of cards, and yeah, you can open it and look, it's going to be junk. You know what I mean? Like, you know what you're probably going to get in those. Maybe you find that fun, and sometimes I do. Sometimes I like just opening up cards and saying, ah, hey, look at some random cards or whatever. But if you're really in this game to find value and find particular cards, it sucks to have to buy these mystery packs, and it ends up being, you know, almost nothing, you know, nothing of value. Not with Arena Club. You can display, again, of all available cards, hit rates, grading, so you know that when you're opening up the slab pack, you are going to get something valuable. You are getting something good. And Arena Club, in addition to having those great slab packs we just talked about, is also a marketplace for card collecting, buying, trading, selling, displaying, all that sort of stuff. But those Arena Club slab packs, man, they are revolutionizing the repack game with transparency. After your pulls are revealed, they'll immediately be placed in your vault for safekeeping or trading and selling, and you can have them officially graded by Arena Club as well. So again, setting these things off, it's going to be officially graded by Arena Club. And the Arena Club grading process is accurate, fast, and transparent, with full grade rationale provided and explanation of how your card was scored. So whether you're buying, selling, trading, or displaying, Arena Club is the card collecting platform that you have to check out. So right now, I've got a special offer here for Voices of Wrestling Network listeners. You can get 10% off of your first purchase by going to arenaclub.com/VOWnet. Again, that's arenaclub.com/VOWnet. Now, that's a crazy offer. That's 10% off a $400 slab pack. $40 off right there. 10% off your first purchase. No matter what that purchase is, 10% off. Again, that's arenaclub.com/VOWnet, arenaclub.com/VOWnet for 10% off your first purchase on Arena Club. And we thank them for sponsoring the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. What's going on, guys? This is Rich from the Flagship Podcast here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. If I could have a moment of your time, I'd like to tell you about one of our sponsors, Eufy Video Lock. Eufy Video Lock is a smart lock, a 2K camera, and a doorbell, all 3-in-1, offering you triple security. So you can have everything in one device rather than installing many pieces on your front door. But it's not just for security. The Eufy Video Lock is also for convenience. No more concerns about losing keys, and you can assign passwords to your family members and see them coming back home via the integrated cameras. Some other great features we love about the Eufy Video Lock is it is easy to install and set up with just a Phillips screwdriver, no drilling required. Keyless entry, no more fumbling for keys when your hands are full. You never have to worry about kids losing keys or passing among renters. You also have 0.3 second fingerprint recognition and 1 second unlocking. Again, 0.3 seconds, it's going to recognize your fingerprints, and in 1 second, it's going to unlock. And with the AI self-learning chip embedded, the more you use it, the more accurate it will be. Also, no battery anxiety. You have a rechargeable battery in there that could last around 4 months, and you will get a low battery notification before it runs out. Passcode unlocking, a remote control with a 2K clear sight, see who's at your door, and control from anywhere through the Eufy app. With enhanced night vision, you can have optimized view even in the evening. You can also secure your package delivery by view and two-way audio. And then best of all, no monthly fee. A bunch of other brands out there are going to charge you a monthly fee. You have your recordings locally and you never have to pay for storage. Customer service, Eufy's got you handled as well. They are on standby for you 24/7 so you can enjoy a worry-free experience with an 18-month warranty, all backed by their professional customer service team. Contact them anytime by telephone, email, or live chat. Personally, as a homeowner, I love my Eufy Video Lock. I have the ability to see what's going on when I'm not home, when packages has arrived, and really the thing I love the most about it, the ease of being able to lock and unlock my doors without having to fumble with my keys, reach in my pocket, or wait, no, crap, they're in my backpack, all that sort of stuff. All this is happening while my dogs are barking at me. You know what? Not anymore with the Eufy Video Lock. I touch it. 0.3 second fingerprint recognition, 1 second. Door is unlocked. Much, much easier. So if you want to jump on board with Eufy Video Lock, search Eufy Video Lock. That is E-U-F-Y Video Lock. Again, that's Eufy Video Lock, E-U-F-Y Video Lock, or visit eufyofficial.com/videolock to see how you can gain complete control of your door.
On what they're going for. Maybe it is that triple threat triangle gate match that I think would be absolutely terrific if they did. I don't know. But they clearly have confidence in these kids to give them what is starting to become a pretty interesting storyline. I really like what they're doing on the undercards, and I hope it continues until we see their elevation.
Yeah, and it's something that it's kind of directly in contrast of what happens with the Kakuta on the next match, but it's like, they were able to handle the guys. And it's kind of been like an interesting storyline of them having rookie matches, them having like special challenge matches where they were able to go like 10 minutes and then they'd finally get put down. They were able to show fight, but they were sticking with them. Now it's not just that they're sticking with the veterans. It's that they are either actively better or they have their number, but they still don't have the finishing stretch. They don't have the kill shot yet because you had the idea that Kakuta got the pin on Yoshida after Kobune clocked him in the face. Then we had the one that this was a misfire, but they were able to capitalize on it. And it's so interesting to me because in contrast to other companies and how they treat rookies, it's like, no, these guys are progressing. You could see them getting better and better, and they're kind of putting it together. And it's such a fulfilling thing to see, like, okay, not only are they able to handle this and equip themselves, and if this was like 3 months ago, this would have been like an absolute beatdown. This would have been like that Kobe Sambo Hall match that, you know, that was truly exceptional. But this is like so fulfilling to see this, that like they're getting it together. They're not all the way there yet. I mean, they're not beating them without like misfires or without distractions, but they understand enough and they're good enough to be like, oh, we see this opportunity in front of us. All right, we're going to take this opportunity and go with it. And I find that very fulfilling and one of those things that makes the show incredibly watchable, at least this week as well.
Well, I'm so glad they didn't spend months and months of beating down these guys and having their heads get kicked in, because we got a month of that. Most of August was these guys stepping up to these legends, giving it their all, and falling short. But instead of just repeating that cycle for the next 6 months, these wrestlers have evolved, and now their matches look different, and they're bringing new things to the table. And because of that, in a kayfabe sense, but also in a very real sense, they are evolving as wrestlers, and it's really nice to see a constant evolution. And I understand that a company like New Japan has the way they do things, and it's going to take them 3 or 4 years to escape the black tights, and then they're going to go on excursion for a year, and then they'll come back, and maybe they'll be a Hiromu, or maybe they'll be a Master Wato. That's up for fate to decide. But with Dragon Gate, it's just, I don't know, maybe it's, you know, the young person in me, the new generation, the person that wants instant gratification, but it is so nice seeing Kabune and Kamai growing up in the now. Like, it's just, it's nice to see where they were in December, and now 10 months later, here's where they are now, and there's been a definitive change and a definitive evolution, and I like that. I think it's really, really nice to see.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that I've always, like, the whole, you lose for 2 years, and you go on excursion, and then you suddenly start winning. Like, we're used to that structure, but I don't feel like it's entirely realistic with how, like, athletes work, in a way. Like, not to go tell Kenny Omega, and I sell like how athletes sell, which, you know, it's kind of wild that he even said that. But it makes sense, like, seeing people progress, like, especially someone so young in their career, match by match, month by month, that if you're getting beat down by everyone over, like, a two-year period, and you go away and come back in a year and you're suddenly winning, then you're like, did you like find Michael's secret drink from Space Jam? Like, that's the only way it makes sense here. Whereas this makes entirely perfect sense to me, like the idea of, oh no, like they've been stepping it up, and it rewards people who've been kind of following it as well, and you're like, okay, these kids are figuring it out there. And maybe some people call it instant gratification, and this might be a hot take, but I think this is more natural expectation of athletics in a way. So I found that incredibly, I find incredibly fulfilling to say that. And then in the next match, we had Kakuta getting the win over Kagetora with the Rolling Lariat in 13:37. Kakuta teamed with Masato Yoshino, which was kind of interesting. And Genki was with his former Jimmy's teammate, Kagetora, as well. And it's something where Kagetora and Kakuta has such good chemistry that made me think of, when was last time I really enjoyed Kagetora this much? And it might have been like the matches he had with Yamamura when he was Brave Gate champion.
Yeah, look, I mean, you're coming to the right department here of people that have been perpetually disappointed by Kagetora, but I thought this match ruled, and I thought a large part of that was him, and like I said earlier, him and Kakuta just beating each other up in a way that was so incredibly satisfying. And I really think that is why the Shingo comp at least needed to be floated out there, because Kakuta's coming across like a tough guy. And that is something that we see it with Fuji and with Mochizuki and with Okuda, and I think to an extent Ishida. Although Ishida is another story. He really reminds me of 2003 Kenta, which is just about as nice of a compliment as I can give somebody. It's really high praise, but there's something about Kakuta that comes across very tough in a promotion that is typically very flashy and very based on skill, and I kind of just feel like in the Dragon Gate bar fight, which I hope one day they do, similar to, Mike, do you remember the APA bar fight on a random WWE pay-per-view 15 years ago? I hope they book that one day in Dragon Gate, and I just hope that we've got Fuji throwing young boys across bar tables, and obviously if there's ever a situation for Kenichiro Arai to thrive in, that is going to be it. I'm sure, like, Ultimo is probably pretty deadly in that situation, but I think the sleeper, I think the guy you're going to get the best odds are in that Dragon Gate bar fight is Madoka Kakuta, because he comes across really tough, and he did in this match, and I thought it was, especially coming after Kabune and Kamai getting such an impressive victory, even if it was through nefarious circumstances, seeing Kakuta get a clean win here was a very interesting thing to see. Again, it's building that momentum, and I really like to see it.
Yeah, and like the big moment was in the closing stretch when it was Kagetora and Kakuta doing a slap fight, just chopping the crap out of each other. And then there's a slight moment where Kagetora had like his wrist tape. He takes off his gloves and his wrist tape, and he's like, all right, we want to do this. We're going to do this. That I think Kagetora has to be on one side of the bar fight, because he's like the unassuming guy that's like, well, I guess this is happening, and like just getting himself ready. And absolutely, Kenichiro Arai has to be involved. He's probably the person in the back alley chain smoking bargain brand cigarettes and trying to call up his guy to make a bet on a horse race. Like we need to have Kenichiro Arai's back alley. I feel like that's the next rookie, like rookie mentorship thing, is kids who just want to learn to be absolute dirt bags.
Well, the other thing with Kagetora, if we're going to continue on this bar fight analogy, which I do find to be very fun, is that Kagetora is a dude that gets bored easily. I mean, he left Dragon Gate, or I guess, you know, he left Toriumon and never really transitioned into Dragon Gate. Toriumon X, right?
Yeah, he was Toriumon X. He was the former Suicito.
That's what it was. But he abandoned the promotion and then, you know, goes to El Dorado and is working Big Japan and, you know, found himself, you know, in the U.S. indie scene for a half a second. He's a dude that gets bored, and I'm afraid that that boredom could manifest itself into very violent energy if he is provoked in the wrong way.
Yeah, and it's something where, like, I mean, he was in Michinoku Pro for a while. He was someone that before he kind of, like, stabilized and was in Dragon Gate full-time, he would get around. This is a guy that would get around. So it gives him something to like, sink his teeth into, and I felt like that pretty important. And what better way to sink your teeth into it than fighting in a bar with, like, Madoka Kakuto? Is like, well, I guess we're doing this now. Because I imagine he's a very unassuming person that's like, well, we're fighting now, I guess. And then he starts, like, throwing bombs. Whereas Kakutora is like, hey, punk, we're doing this. All right, ripping off the wrist tape. Let's do this.
I think we have nailed this analogy, Mike. I'm really proud of both of us.
Well, speaking about someone getting nailed, it was the next match was a trios match with the Toriumon team of Ultimo Dragon, Dragon Kid, and Shuji Kondo versus Kazuma Sakamoto, Diamante, and Hyo of RED. And after a low blow that was the best-sold low blow of all time, Diamante pinned Ultimo Dragon. You know what, kids? When we're recording this on a Thursday, of course, this is the 8th. I was surprised by the power of the principal that after such a devastating low blow was able to send a video to his good friend Chris Jericho.
Look, more power to him. That is obviously the buzz of wrestling Twitter today, as the founder of Toriumon and the figurehead of Dragon Gate making waves in AEW. There's no other Japanese promotion that is getting a lot of press about that today, so it's nice to see Dragon Gate in the forefront of people's minds. But Mike, I mean, we talked about Southern style tags earlier. We talked about continental wrestling. Ultimo is so old school, and I love it so much. This man takes a low blow, and he sold it more than any single move is going to get sold on the collective this weekend. We're going to see, Mike, you're going to have to review these shows beyond the paywall, and I know you're looking forward to it. Some contrived, I feel like Patrick Ewing, the step back one-legged jumper. Do practice that shot. We're gonna see some top rope Canadian destroyer through a door and a glass pallet at the collective this weekend, and the guy's gonna pop right back up. It's gonna be the big spot that he no-sells a move that should result in death. Ultimo Dragon got kneed in the groin,
and it was not a very strong looking kick.
No,
like, let's get this clear
on camera.
Yeah.
You would have thought this man had gotten shot multiple times. He was down in a prone position. He did not leave the ring under his own power. He was carried to the back by Shuji Kondo. He is all about protecting his image. He is the best man in wrestling. This moment alone makes Ultimo's return entirely worth it.
I mean, I don't want to talk about the forbidden door being open when the Dragon's Gate opened. And not to go on a full tangent, I imagine there were a couple people who were pretty peeved to see that Ultimo had a video on Dynamite who probably were like sitting at home going, he's here now? Or he's
oh,
doing
come
now?
On. Like, oh, we got to do this again? That's, you know, that's the thing. I was also very surprised, and I guess maybe we're the people that need to fuel that speculation. Maybe we need to tweet out some cryptic things. But
should we start astroturfing things? You know how I love like starting a brand, basically, and speaking things into the power case. You're talking to the right person.
It just seems like Shima, and I'll name names. I'll do it. This is the Open the Voice Gate podcast. We name names. Shima's someone that sits down every single week and posts on social media how excited he is to watch Dynamite. And I will do another check, but I believe this man has been silent about Dynamite this week.
I'm right now checking his Twitter account, SuperShima1115.
He's watching the Jericho Anniversary show. There's a tweet from last night.
Yeah, saying it was amazing. And that was it. I wonder the thoughts that were racing through what was going on in the Oshima household last night.
Look, that's a question I'm constantly wondering. It seems like a fascinating existence between that and, unfortunately, that horrible, what was it, a bike accident he was in a few weeks ago?
Yeah, he was hit by a car on his bicycle.
Can you imagine the life, like, and look, I love Shima, but this dude's going from, there's a video of him sitting behind the merch table in a closet watching T-Hawk and Zero-One. A few days later, he gets hit by a car on his bike, and then he's like, well, finally I get to come home and watch my favorite wrestling show, AEW Dynamite, and Ultimo Dragon appears.
What a week for him. Well, but Case, you can still pay $88 to go sit in an art gallery and watch a show live, or watch it from his cell phone for $30.
Oh boy,
I'm just gonna leave that thought hanging here as we move on to something that was an appearance of its own, as it was a no contest in the singles match on the show, Daya and Yoshida, because we had interference. We have a new debut. It was Dia Inferno, who came out, unmasked Daya. Sounds like that should be like a disqualification. I feel like in the rule books, I'm going to take this up with GM Yagi, because if you ask me, you unmask someone and you start attacking them, that's the person who got attacked. He gets the match because there's an interference from the other side. But we have now a new member of RED, Daya Inferno. In Case, how long have I been saying I want to see a generational rival with Dragon Daya? I feel like I've been saying this since the start.
That is accurate. I can come on this podcast and say that is something you have been wishing for a long time. Now let's play the fun game. You know, we've got a demon that was unveiled later in the show. But now we have Daya Inferno, who I do need to say up top, what an amazing debut. I mean, how good was this segment, Mike?
It's like the one time that I'm sad that there was... that the protocols were there, just because of the amount of shock and horror that you could feel through the crowd, because you could sense the crowd being silent in a way that they probably would be shrieking or booing. Like, it was like one of those things that it's like dead silence. Inferno comes out, he attacks Daya, rips off his mask from a standing base, which is something that usually you don't do, because then you could like do this. So this guy just did not care. He has Drago's mask, but better. He's wearing like all black with blood splatters. He has a dry fit on, which for the guy who I think it is, probably don't drop the dry fit. Like, it makes it more obvious who you are. And just like RED having to hold him back from Daya as Daya escaped. What a debut for Daya Inferno.
Barking like a dog, basically, at the Dragon Gate generation. It was unbelievable how vicious, and I used the word unhinged in my review. I mean, this is as good of a debut as I've ever seen. And think about, you know, the Dr. Muscles and whatever other characters.
Metal Warrior,
thank you. You know, that Dragon Gate typically uses, even these demons. I've never seen anything come across quite like this. I mean, he looked deranged, and it's not just that he came in the ring and attacked Dragon Daya. He comes in the ring and stands in between Yoshida and Daya, and then kind of waves Yoshida off before attacking him, and that few seconds where he was standing in between the two was absolutely horrifying. I mean, it was so well done, and now we get him wrestling immediately. He's on the Kyoto show that we'll preview in just a minute, but you referenced the dry fit. You think that gives away who it is. I think I have scientific reasoning behind my pick for who it is. We're probably on the same page, but let's get it out in the open. Let's pour some gasoline on this fire and name names like I just talked about, Mike. Who do we think is under the Daya Inferno mask?
I would say with 60% probability that it's Yuki Yoshioka.
Mike, do you remember anything from the March 2020 Cork and Hall card, the show that never ended up happening? It was headlined by a GHC title match that was eventually moved to the empty arena. But do you remember anything else from that show?
Oh, it was supposed to be Yoshioka versus Daya.
It was supposed to be Yoshioka versus Daya in match 3. And then from there, Yoshioka was going to go to Mexico. So I can say with 98% certainty that under this mask is Yuki Yoshioka. And look, he's never had a singles match against Dragon Daya. If you look on their cage matches, it's not like they've even wrestled each other all that much. It seems like for two guys that debuted roughly around the same time period, they've only got 11 matches with one another. They've kind of bypassed each other along the way, and one of those matches was on a Prime Zone, so you're really looking at 10 legitimate matches, all tags, most of them non-televised, some even where they're teaming against one another, so we really don't have a good feel for what their chemistry is like. But whatever critiques, and they weren't even critiques, but you have to remember, we were comparing Yoshioka to a Susumu Yokosuka, almost that silent killer type, someone that didn't really have the charisma of a Yamato, or if I almost said Shima, of a Yamato or a BB Hulk or one of these top-level guys. Under this mask, oh my god, he comes across like a killer. It is so cool to see, assuming this is Yoshioka, the transformation that happened during this excursion, because even though he's under a mask, he feels just reborn. I mean, this was such an exciting debut, and now I'm even more excited to see him work, because the storyline all year has been Dragon Daya cannot get over R.E.D. He cannot overcome this heel unit, and now they've got a guy in there specifically to torment him.
Yeah, and just to, like, he was someone that, like, the big thing about Yoshioka leaving wasn't, like, it was going to be, like, a learning excursion. It was something about getting him out of everyone's hair for a while. Like, it was like, maybe he picks up some things, but we just kind of need him to go do this. We kind of need Yoshioka to go do something else for a little bit. And why would you need to have someone go do something else for a little bit? Because you're going to bring him in as the generational rival of the next generation of the Dragon Legacy. Like, it writes itself. And to, like, put a further point on this, I said 60% for Yoshioka, right? That's what I said a couple minutes ago.
That is what you said.
The only other possibility given body type is it's a new debut. Like, it does not fit Shun Skywalker. The last time I saw him a couple weeks ago in Mexico, he is still kind of a lanky boy. You know, he did not put on mass. Yoshioka, when he was in Mexico, not saying that he was out of shape. He was someone that just kind of, you know, like, he was not hitting the gym as much as this. He was not lean. And I feel like that's what the dry fit kind of giveaway.
Yeah, it's either Yoshioka or, I mean, we know for a fact there are more people in the dojo waiting to make their debut. If somehow it's one of those guys, then, oh my god, I mean, we are on to something special here. Forget the debut of Strong Machine J and, you know, the debuts of Jun Akiyama as these all-time historical debuts. If this guy hits the ground running in Kyoto, we've got another conversation to have, given the rumors that we've heard coming out of the Dragon Gate Dojo and the talent that is there now. But I don't see that being the case here, storyline-wise, and with your reasoning for the excursion that Yoshioka went on, it would make perfect sense that it's him. I think it's him, and I think we'll have a much better inclination coming out of the KBS Hall show this weekend.
Yeah, and I feel like that a lot of things will be decided in Kyoto. The next match we had, do you have any other takes on Inferno before we move on? Like, I'm stoked. Like, I've been calling this for this for like about a year now, or well over a year now. This is like the perfect thing to do for Daya. It makes sense now, everything that's played out, that not only does R.E.D. have his number, they have a secret weapon against him. Like, now it makes sense there. And, you know, it's something that I hope they don't burn through this. This is something that, like, one of the cool things about Dragon Kid versus Darkness Dragon was it went to such a fever pitch that they had to have the mask versus mask match at Absolute Munte. So that's what I'm hoping for in this. And for someone, like, if this ends up being who we think this is, great use of Yoshioka. He's like, he was always going to be like the quiet Susumu guy. This gives him something else. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah, so, my final thoughts on the debut is that for as great as the main event was, this segment, the Daya versus Yoshida match and the debut of Daya Inferno, this is the essential viewing. If you watch one thing from this show, it's this segment. If you haven't seen it yet, pause the podcast, watch the segment, and then come back to us to break down the last two matches. But this was such a home run. This was so great to see.
I mean, I'm going to find time to watch the English commentary version, because I'm excited to see what Jay has to say about this and how Ho-Ho Loon's going to react to this. Like, it's that powerful of a moment, in my opinion.
We probably need to go back and do some work on the Dragon Kid versus Kness feud, or I guess the Darkness Dragon feud, and maybe attempt, as this feud goes along, this contemporary feud, to draw some parallels between the two, because that is, for Torimon especially, that was peak storytelling there. And the impression that I've got from people that have connections to, I will say they have connections to the storyline, but they're not Dragon Gate affiliated. I heard from some interesting people about Inferno, people that I don't typically hear from a day or two after a Cork and Hall show. I think this is this has a chance to be really high level storytelling, and I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, me too. And it's gonna be a cool thing. I mean, the look is awesome, and it's one of those things that you see a guy like this, you see him do things like this, and even if you aren't a big Dragon System head, you're like, that dude looks like a badass, and that's powerful. And I think that draws interest. Like, I've heard more from people over the last few days for that as well, or the last 24 hours rather. And then we had a six-man tag team match. It was Team Boku of Naruki Toys, Ryo Saito, and Ryota Shimizu versus the Dragon Gate Generation team of Yokosuka San Maria, Punch Tominaga, and UT. It was Shimizu with the Ultimo style La Magistral Cradle over Punch Tominaga. And like, this is just like, was like, there's not a whole lot about this match. It was a fun match, in my opinion. We got to see the world's largest or highest Skylove, which was cool.
And thank just you for mentioning that. That Skylove was absolutely insane.
Yeah, yeah. It's just one of those things that it's, I mean, Shimizu has always been a big boy. He's a powerful boy. He was nationally ranked at one point with the shot put. That's why it was called the shot put slam. So no wonder he was able to help base and launch Maria that high in the air with that. And it just was, this was just like dudes being dudes. Guys rock. You know what I mean? That's what the dudes rock. That's how Team Boku really is. So I enjoyed this a lot. This was just like a fun thing. And it's something that, you know, then they immediately tried to recruit Punch Tominaga post-match, and Punch Tominaga seemed frustrated and said, like, I don't know yet. But we get resolution about that going to the main event. Do you have any other big thoughts about the trios tag?
No, it was a disappointing Cork and semi-main event from a match quality perspective, but it was only 9 minutes, and we got an angle coming out of it, so it's hard to complain about it too much.
Yeah, yeah. And then we had the main event. This was Dragon Gate versus RED. Dragon Gate team was Yamato, KZ, Benkei, and Kota Minenora going against Ada, BB Hulk, Kaido Ishida, and Kai. Really, like, the top four of both units going head-to-head against each other. The finish was when they got everyone isolated, and it was just Benkei and Kaido Ishida, and then we had the Yellow Mask Demon pop into the ring, unmask himself as Keisuke Okuda, and after a moment, he was able to... He did a spin kick that looked like it was going for Benkei, but instead it hit Kaido Ishida. Ben was able to roll him up, pin Ishida, and it was revealed that the Yellow Demon Mask all along was a giant ruse. The best bros are best bros for life.
What an awesome angle. I mean, this was done so well, and part of it is legitimate in this best bros ideology that you just mentioned. The genuine joy that seemed to drip off the faces of Benkei and Okuda after the match, and the handshake that they immediately go into, like, this was a special moment that I think Dragon Gate was able to capitalize on some very just human elements that I think are so void in wrestling typically. You know, it's not like tag teams typically come across as friends. You know, they come across as co-workers, really. Benkei and Okuda, after this match, came across like best friends, which they are, and it was just a really nice moment after my, you know, I'm watching this live, and the demon unmasked, and who's it gonna be, and it's Okuda, and I kind of sank a little bit, like, oh, man, that's a bummer, and then he roundhouse kicks Ishida, and I am back in immediately, because this is the best Brave Gate feud we've had in nearly a decade. For as enjoyable as the rise of KZ into Tozawa into Kotoka was, this Ishida versus Okuda thing is the best thing in the scene since Pac versus Ricochet.
Yeah, yeah. It's something that, out of wrestling, and again, inherent bias is always here. I don't feel like I should even really have to say that, but I feel like I should. This is why this is the best feud in wrestling in 2020. They built it up in such a way that I was like, no, everyone thought you were getting in my head. No, me and my gym class best friend, we managed to pull a fast one over like the conniving, like the guy who was stirring the drink, the guy who seemed like he had his number was getting to his head. No, he didn't. It was the time for the bros to get one over on it. And it just felt like so good, and like was like the perfectly logical way after all this, like, no, and we aren't done. I'm facing a Gate of Destiny. That's a Brave Gate match here, and just incredible thing. And it came after a match that was just clicking on so many levels in a way that Dragon Gate's able to both have the output and then have these emotional moments like tie in and weave like incredibly fulfilling story that would fit in any year of the Dragon System, COVID or not.
Do you know, and you would be the person that would know better than me, is there a relationship between Kotama and Nora and BB Hulk behind the scenes? Because I think it was either Alan Forrell or Joe Lanza that mentioned, you know, Hulk took the fall in the Memorial Gate Twin Gate match to Minoru, and I believe on the July 15th Osaka show, Minoru pinned Hulk as well. And in this match, Hulk was just so giving to Minoru and bumped so well for his offense. Maybe they just like each other. Maybe Hulk's just being a professional. But I don't know if there's a deeper relationship there.
Not to my knowledge. I don't know of one. They're not. I mean, Hulk famously is a guy from Hokkaido. He's from, and that's like a very isolating place when you compare it to like the rest of Japan. That's why him and KZ were such a big deal as two guys from KZ from Ebetsu and Hulk from Sapporo. Like that was a big thing. I don't think that they have that kind of relationship. I think they just work well together, or maybe there might be a mentorship happening that I haven't heard of, but not to my knowledge.
They really do work well together. I think in this current iteration of Hulk, which is, you know, he's someone that's slower than most guys on the roster now, and he really has to rely on his strikes to get him over. His best chemistry on the roster is with Minoru. It's not with Yamato or with Kai, who he spent most of the past year wrestling. Mm-hmm. It's Minoru who he works really, really well against, and it seems like there's a genuine appreciation for from Minoru's side, what Hulk has done in his career, and then from Hulk's side, what he can do for Minoru's career. And so, while this match was loaded with, again, you know, Yamato, KZ, Benkei, Eita, Ishida, Kai, it is Minoru and Hulk that stood out to me most outside of the demon angle, just because I think those two work really, really well together.
Yeah, yeah, and it's something that, like, they've now gotten to a point in this feud where, like, we're now getting, like, these great eight-man tags that are main eventing, semi-main eventing between these two feuds that it's in a lot of ways pretty interesting to me, because this stuff is, like, happening, but it's also happening with, like, you have another team in there that's not as participating. Like, pretty much the only big difference between this and the semi-main event of the first show in Fukuoka was you had Yamato in there for Yosuke Sanmaria, you had Benkei in there, And then you had Kazuma with Ishida. So, like, I mean, like, they're getting to a point now where the, at least Dragon Gate Army and RED, now you have at least five or six people, you know? It's one of those things that it's really fulfilling, and you just throw together, like, a combinations of these teams, and they all work together, and people have, like, special chemistry. Like, KZ and Ishida had, like, the strike exchange that they were using the crane, so they got in tight to them, and it was, like, exceptional stuff as well. And it's just really, like, enjoyable, like having like these, like this warfare work out in this way. Like, are there things we're more wondering about, more turns, more just kind of things like this? Not as much as before, but I think like the ring output now is reaching a point where it did feel kind of weird talking about like Blood Warriors and Junction 3 in comparison to this, but the ring output is, I would argue, up there, if not just a little shade below.
We're missing the one or two really high-end match of the year contender matches, part of that being that Eita just hasn't defended his title yet, so maybe that narrative starts to shift a little bit after Gate of Destiny, because part of why Blood Warriors versus Junction 3 was so special was we had Masaki Mochizuki's Open the Dream Gate run, which is a tier below Kenta Kobashi's GHC Heavyweight Championship reign, but on the same level as Samoa Joe's Ring of Honor World title run, or Brian Danielson's Ring of Honor World title run, or whatever 21st century comparison you want to make, with the exception of Kobashi, which is the greatest title run ever, Masaki Mochizuki was on that next tier, and he was carrying guys like Yasushi Kanda and Cyber Kong to the best matches of their career, and then giving people like BB Hulk and Akira Tozawa the best matches of their career. So we're missing the really high-end stuff there, and then, you know, Mike and I, if you're, for whatever reason, not listening to our Dragon Gate USA Rewind and Rewatch shows, we just completed 2011, or I think we're going to finish our, the final show of 2011 will air this upcoming Monday.
Right.
And we, me especially, but Mike, every once in a while, would dip in and rewatch some of the Junction 3 versus Blood Warrior stuff that was going on in 2011 in Japan, and you know, for as great as this match was, it wasn't quite on the level of maybe some of the more high-end multi-man matches, but I think we're basing this generational warfare off of Blood Warriors versus Junction 3, which saw Blood Warriors form in January of 2011, similar to when this generational warfare took off. Now, it took Junction 3 5 months to fully form, and then we had, you know, essentially 9 months of this full two-unit warfare thing going on. But I think, and I don't know if it's this way with you, but I have just projected, like, well, generational warfare will probably be done in February of 2021, because that's what they did with Blood Warriors versus Junction 3. But there's nothing that says they have to finish it there. You know, this could go into World of next year, and if the storytelling continues to be as interesting as it is right now, I will be more than welcome to that, because I really like what they're doing, and I think they not only have more time to have those high-end matches, but I still think we're a turn or two and a swerve or two away from this feud being all said and done. I think they still have a lot of ideas left in the tank for specifically Toriyama versus Dragon Gate versus RED.
Yeah. Like, we're coming to a point now where it's like the pot is simmering, but it's what brings to a full boil. And you're right, that needs like the big thing. They need like a couple more of the big turns, and they need like the exceptional top of the line matches that make people. They've done a lot of stuff of elevating people, like we've talked about Kota Minenora a lot, like moving him and giving him the rocket pack over the last 3 months. But you're absolutely right about that as well. It's just something that is very enjoyable to watch this feud right now, especially in comparison to the rest of what's going on in wrestling right now, being like, all right, now I'm starting to feel things being built up in the fever pitch, and then you immediately get that the next show. So it'll be very interesting to see things post-match. Of course, we already talked about the Yellow Demon Mask reveal being Keisuke Okuda. Also, after the match, Pancho Managa made his decision. He is going to join Team Boku, and Dragon Gate Army was like, oh, yeah, no, that's cool. Bye. And I thought that was really fun. Funny, like, Jason Lee in the background just waving bye-bye at Pancho Managa, and Pancho Managa being mad that the people weren't fighting for him to stay.
Arguing this hard for Pancho Managa is the Dragon Gate equivalent of tanking, and you know, we'll see if this process, maybe this is what it is. Maybe Big R Shimizu trusts the process more than the 76ers ever did, and he's going to recruit Punch Tamanaga to reset him on the card. And then maybe by this time next year, we're looking at Open the Dreamgate champion Ryotsu Shimizu. Who knows what could happen? All I know is that if you look at the Dragon Gate website right now, Doi and Saito are affiliated with both Team Boku and Toriyama Generation. Punch Tamanaga, fully Team Boku 24/7.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, he embodies the Boku spirit. Like, the fact that, like, he's joining in there, and he's joining the poker game. You know, he's bringing up here. Maybe he has, like, a nice, like, maybe he's going to order pizza for the guys. Maybe if we're going to go back to the poker night analogy, he's the one to make sure the food is ready for them, but everyone's like, okay, he's kind of a fuck up, but, you know, he always gets the good pizza.
That's interesting. I don't see Punch having money. I think he's the guy that you constantly need to spot a five for. Punch Tamanaga is the walking embodiment of I'll get you later, and that is sort of the vibe that I pick up from him there. The only reason that he's invited to poker night is that he's been invited to poker night for the last 8 years, and what are we gonna do? Yeah. Not invite him? Like, we don't want to deal with that headache. He's here, we have to deal with it.
Yeah, we have to invite him. I mean, he doesn't have much else going on in his life. You know, I mean, he's really holding on to this last thing, you know? Like, this is the one thing of each week he's looking forward to, whereas the rest of the guys like, oh, yeah, no, I'll go do this, but tomorrow I gotta go to Costco with the wife. So
let's talk about Kyoto KBS Hall on October 11th.
Yep, that's gonna be on the 11th. That they will be back in Kyoto. Interesting card. Just, like, running down the matches, we have an opener of the Toriyama team of Masato Yoshino, Susumu Yokosuka, and Tsuji Kondo versus Jason Lee, Yosuke Samaria, and Jimmy. We didn't talk a lot about Jimmy. Jimmy has been getting more and more work, and it's something that it's nice to see more of Jimmy so far in the show. I think this is he was not at Korakuen, and he was not on. Oh no, he was on Korakuen. Never mind. No, he wasn't.
No, he was not.
I'm confused. So I mean, like, 3 out of 4 shows for him is a definite step up. He was someone that needed to get the ring time. I'm happy he's back here. Other than that, that looks like an opener to me.
Yeah, I like that Jimmy's here. I think he's going to get killed by Tsuji Kondo, and it should be a lot of fun.
Yeah. Singles match, Kagetora versus Diamante. I think we all can see where this is going to go with that match. No reason to delve into it too much. Tag team match, UT and Takeda Kamei. They are the small beans of the roster versus Kento Kabune and Madoka Kakuta. That's going to be a real interesting tag given the last week, in my opinion. I think that it's going to be interesting. And getting to see UT try to like grab a hold on Kakuta is incredibly fascinating to me.
Yeah, Jesus, I had not thought about that. UT and Kamei are a really small team, but I think we're going to see Kabune and Kakuta get the win over UT here. I think for as talented as he is, he's just hurt all the time, so UT is really the lowest-ranking member of the Dragon Gate generation, right. And I think they want these rookies getting pins over main roster guys, and that's what we're going to see here. This match should be a lot of fun, though. I'm really excited about this.
Yeah. And then we're going to get into a stretch of matches that are going to be really interesting, in my opinion. Starting from there, Torimon versus RED, Ultimo and Genki versus Benkei and Minenora. So mixed teams, but, you know, I mean, poor Genki, he's going to be taking a lot of this, but, you know, it'll be a good time.
Well, okay, so that's what I wanted to ask you. Is there a situation here where Benkei takes the fall? Because Horiguchi, he's in that Gate of Destiny twin gate match, isn't he?
Yes.
I don't think Horiguchi is taking the pin. I don't think Minora is taking the pin, and we know Ultimo's not taking the pin. I think Horiguchi's backsliding Benkei here.
Yeah, and that's happened a couple weeks ago, so I'm with you on that. Semi-main event, apparently Naruki Doi did not have better things to do because he's going to be teaming with Shimizu and Tomonaga. Team Boku versus BB Hulk, Takashi Yoshida, and Kazuma Sakamoto. This will be a fascinating tag match to kind of just see Doi dealing with the knucklehead.
Yeah, the dynamics are going to be off the charts here. I guess maybe... I mean, they've got to save some stuff for Kobe World. I don't see a lot of stuff being built for World, because I thought when they booked Ishida versus Okuda, just for the sake of variety, they would throw that onto the big show, but they put it on Gate of Destiny instead. So my inclination with Yoshida and Sakamoto in this match is, well, maybe they do the Triangle Gate match there, and then we can scrap our nine-man Triangle Gate match for World that we discussed earlier. But I don't know. I think Team Boku is getting a Triangle Gate shot sooner rather than later. I guess we just have to figure out what show it's on.
Yeah. Or you just have Tomonaga lose. You know, I mean, Tomonaga can... In every match, the safe option is always to say Tomonaga takes the fall. So, I mean, we could be saying all these things about Team Boku and then nothing happens because it's Tomonaga. Like, there's always that option.
That is very true.
Something that I did notice, like, just briefly touching on the Gay Destiny match, this would be 365 days. Not a full calendar year because we had the leap day this year, but 365 days if Ishida retains in his hometown at the arena he won the title at Gate of Destiny 2019, he will cross the one-year mark as Brave Gate champion.
I'm not ready to make any predictions yet, but I think...
I thought that was fascinating. That was a fascinating thing.
It's a good stat, and you can say, you know, COVID cost us this and that, and maybe it should disqualify Ishida from this conversation, but other than Pac's 2011 run, which again is untouchable, I hope we never see anyone surpass that range just because I don't know what they would have to do. It seems like it would be a threat to public safety to have a better run than Pac did with this belt. But Ishida's now up there as one of the best individual Brave Gate champions we've ever seen. And no matter the result of the Okuda match, whether he retains or whether Okuda ends his reign at exactly 365 days, it's an all-time great Brave Gate run and one that should be remembered as such.
Absolutely, it should be. And speaking about Ishida and Okuda, they are in the main event. This is the Dragon Gate versus RED 8-man tag. Yamato, KZ, Keisuke Okuda, and Dragon Daya are going up against Ada, Kaito Ishida, Kai, and the debuting Daya Inferno. So we're going to know real quick, and we might be real dummies here. We might be real dummies, and this could be a debutee. It could be that somehow over the last 3 weeks, Shun Skywalker decided to bulk up, but we will be able to probably figure out pretty quickly who Daya Inferno is in this match. And I'm stoked to see like what the style is going to be. Like he's basically been treated as a mad dog. Well, how about you face against Mr. Danger Zone, Keisuke Okuda, in this match? What's going to happen when Inferno is unleashed on KZ? the person, like, is he going to try to protect Ada in front of this Dreamgate match that's going to be happening in a few weeks? And then Yamato's in the mix as well versus Kai. It's a really fascinating preview match, and something that usually we talked about how the preview matches before the cage matches usually feel kind of rote. This one is very interesting to me. Like, this is a good preview match, and we get a lot of new things on offer here, in my opinion.
This is as excited as I've been for a match all year. I mean, legitimately, I am so into this Dia Inferno character after the debut. It can't be Shun. I mean, Shun is 7 inches taller than Yoshioka.
7 centimeters.
Yeah. I was just talking to somebody about the metric system a few days ago and how it's just insane that we don't use it. But that's besides the point. But no, you're right. It is. I misspoke. It is 7 centimeters taller. But still, like, it's not Shun. It doesn't look like Shun. It's not tall enough to be Shun. It's not Shun. It's either someone we don't know or it's Yoshioka, and I lean towards the latter in that argument. And I can't wait to see what he wrestles like. If it's anything like that debut, the movements that he took on, again, essentially barking like a dog at the Dragon Gate Generation, we are in for a treat if he wrestles anything like that. And he's with an A-team of Dragon Gate Generation guys. There's no slouches here. There's no Strong Machine J, or even, with all due respect, Yosuke Santa Maria or a Jason Lee even. Like, these are the top guys in the unit. And so This has a chance. And the opposing side, it's not like you've got BB Hulk or Yoshida or even a Diamante. You've got the A-team of RED. So this could be a really, really high-level match in a venue that always hosts good shows but never really has those great matches. I should probably temper my expectations a little bit, but just on paper, I am salivating over the idea of this match. I cannot wait.
Yeah, and that's going to be the show that's going to be on the Dragon Gate Network on the 11th, 5 p.m. Japanese Standard Time. That's 4 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Central, and 9 a.m. Greenwich Mean Time, I believe. I don't have my clock in front of me. But it's a loaded card, especially for Kyoto, and I'll be interested to see what's going on from there. We've already pretty much talked about everything that was added on to Gated Destiny. Schedule ahead, they will be back in the hollow ground of Kobe Sambo Hall on the 17th. They will be tipping Nara. We were thinking that they were, and they are. They're going to be tipping Nara for Doi's 20th anniversary. And that's it for the month of October. They're lulling us into this because I've already looked up the schedule, at least for the first part of November. And within a 12-day period, we're getting Gated Destiny, Korakuen Hall, Kyoto, and then Kobe World. So enjoy the relative peace now. It's just going to get crazier from here. Case, I think that's probably going to do it for this week. Do you have anything else you wanted to add or talk about before we get out of here?
That is all I've got.
All right, so that's going to do it for this week of Open the Voice Gate. You can follow our Twitter account at Open Voice Gate. You can follow Case personally at _ in your case. And you can follow me at Fujiheya with two eyes like Don Fuji. But that's going to do it for this week's weekly update. We'll be back with you next week talking about this crazy Kyoto card. So for Case, I'm Mike, and thank you for listening to Open the Voice Gate. Take care.